It's the Mincing Rascals. I'm Justin Kaufman in for John Williams this week. Alderman Ed Burke, should he resign? We'll also talk Springfield in the final hours of this spring session. Much to do. We know there's a lot of places you could be, so we thank you for being here today. Let's mince.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of The Business Lunch on WGN Radio.
Scott Stantis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune and creator of comic strip Prickly City and co-host of the Prickly City podcast right here on WGN Plus.
I'm Eric Zorn, the well-intentioned columnist from the Tribune. I run Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays.
There you go. Well, Justin Kaufman here. I host Extension 720, but lately I've become the Anthony Descalzo of WGN Radio as I am filling in for everybody everywhere. John Show. All right, I think we should start. Springfield, of course, probably is the starting spot because it's Friday. We're recording this May 31st. It's the morning, so things are going to change in the next while.
So wait, on May 31st, the morning, this is when the spring session starts, right?
Yes.
Just about.
So and it's funny you say that because, Steve, you and I had been on the air earlier, and we were talking maybe 2-3 weeks ago about, oh, when's this going to get done? And you said the last day of the last hour, and here we are. You were correct.
There's not been one big thing done yet, has there?
Oh, no. With the agreement to put the graduated income tax on the ballot. And I think that the abortion regulations passing the House was a big hurdle.
But it's not through the Senate.
It's not through the Senate, but the Senate is an easier lift for Democrats. So I'm expecting the abortion legislation to pass today. I don't know what's going to happen with marijuana. I don't know what's going to happen with the budget.
We have the Capitol bill that no one has seen. This is a hell of a way to run a government. No one has seen the budget.
We're still standing. It's been working so far.
Okay. So we're still a state. So that's great. But this is preposterous. I was on the air last night with Patty Vasquez, and she had a number of state representatives, and the Democrats were all cool with this. The Republicans, of course, were livid. I agreed with the Republicans. You don't have a budget. You have less than 12 hours to read it. They literally, do you know how the Republicans do when they get the budget now? They split it up. They say, okay, I'm interested in this section, because the thing is, as you might imagine, it's a multi-billion-dollar budget. And that's just a bad way to govern.
It's garbage politics, and it's something that we kind of got all out of sync with Rauner and Madigan as there was so much behind the scenes, and we never actually saw what was happening. But this seems to be part and parcel to what Mike Madigan does with new laws and things like that.
I don't know for a fact how it works in other states, whether other states take things right to the brink like this or not, and the degree to which it's not good. I agree with Scott. It's crazy. We should have been talking about fine points in the budget for a month now, and instead it's going to get dumped on us
today.
Well, this evening, perhaps.
We have not seen anything of the budget, right?
Or the Capitol bill. I mean, it's like...
Yeah. The Capitol bill has a ton of baked-in taxes.
Oh, we've talked. I mean, the Capitol bill, a little bit more is known about that. We don't have the actual bill, you're right, but we know that they're going
the
to fund it.
The proposal, or what Pritzker wants.
Well, they want to fund it with a doubling of the gas tax, I believe, at least, and then there's going to be...
That doesn't hurt the middle class.
License plate and renewal fees that will go up.
And fees for electric cars going up. There's a lot of moving parts there. There's also gaming that's out there right now. We don't know what's going to do with sports gambling, gaming. Maybe, you know... Every year, how many years have we been around, all of us here, and every year there's going to be a casino in Chicago, and it never happens. It might happen today.
Okay, so let's talk about casinos, because that part of it, and I agree, someone who has covered this stuff and been around Chicago as long as we have, they're always talking and teasing out the idea of adding to the casinos in the state of Illinois. This time, though, they combined what was an issue about just online, or just about betting, and they said, well, what if we throw some casinos on top of
sports betting?
But so... You know, here we are. Are we at the precipice? Are we going to see today more casinos and possibly a Chicago casino get through Springfield?
I think that we will, because it's linked to the Capitol bill, right? And so you're going to have all these constituencies that want this money. Everybody likes Capitol bill money. You can go back to your constituents and say, cut ribbons and so on. And this has been hanging out there for so long. And I've got some misgivings about it. I'm not sure that I want a big casino in Chicago. I'm not sure I want to double the number of video game terminals. I'm not sure that that's good overall for the population, for the public. But, you know, there's a lot of gambling that goes on out of state.
The moral clause kind of went out the window this time. We've heard so much about the morality of casinos. This time around, when we get to pensions and bills, everyone's like,
Can't have the governor pushing to, you know, make a bet on your phone at Guaranteed Rate Field and then make a moral argument against the Chicago casino.
Well, but I do have a problem with a casino that's run by the city, which is one of the proposals. And that's...
I think that's dead, though.
Is that dead? Well, thank goodness, because I got two words for you, Ed Burke. Do you really want someone like that running a casino?
I don't think he'd get the job anymore.
Well, he's not doing anything else.
He definitely put a little pressure on.
He'll have some time on his hands.
He does.
And I want to make... We'll get to Ed Burke in just a second. But as we look at that, when you say a Chicago casino, and obviously Mayor Lightfoot is pushing for that as well, where do you want this casino? Where do you think the best place for a Chicago casino would be?
Michael Reese site. That's mine.
Right in the near South Side?
Near South Side.
I think where they were going to put the Lucas Museum.
Yeah, right.
Oh. Right, okay. Yeah, I like
Jackson
the Michael
Park.
Reese site too. Yeah,
you'd rather have it closer to downtown.
Well, you've got that development. We continue to develop that area, right? That McPlace right. area, and even to the further west of the post office, that whole move south. So, yeah, I think so.
What a great to get to Lori Lightfoot and the mayor. You saw her this week. Win in so many different levels, but you're also seeing a little bit of her being able to flex some muscle. She came out against expanding the restaurant tax, which was a tax that would say that we're going to put tax on restaurant in neighborhoods, not just the ones
well,
downtown.
Well, there's a special taxing right. district right now for restaurants that ostensibly attract tourists.
Right, and so they wanted to expand that so they could renovate McCormick Place. She came out against it. It's dead.
Well, they wanted to expand it, but exempt big arenas like Wrigley Field and Guaranteed Rate. And she said, why?
They pointed to today in Cranes, I think it was, they looked at and said, because she came out against it, they lost any sort of right. energy in Springfield, and McCormick Place is going to have to double back. But it just shows that she is, has a lot of clout, or I don't know what the word would be, but right now she's flexing muscle.
I think that's what happens when you come in with 75% of the vote. I mean, Rahm didn't have the cojones to stand up against Ed Burke. I mean, again, I hate to keep coming back to that, but he kind of took aside, sachet and let Burke do what Burke does for 8 years. She just was like right out of the gates.
Well, in fairness, though, Burke is badly wounded, was even before Thursday. He was a badly wounded guest. I mean, it was great theater on Wednesday when the mayor faced him down and basically told him to take a seat.
Alderman, please. Alderman, I will call you when I'm ready to hear from you.
That was just beautiful. I wonder, though, was she given a little bit of extra spine in that by some sort of inside knowledge?
She knew what was coming.
I mean, she's a former federal prosecutor. Yeah. I assume she's got some contacts in that department. She knew that the next day this was going to be like a 1-2 punch.
She's alluded to that during an editorial board meeting, right? During one
she
of the
did.
Debates.
She thinks there are more. I was surprised that there aren't more indictments, yeah. and there may be more coming down.
She was asked about that today, and she said, well, you know, with Danny Solis wearing a wire for 2 years
exactly.
at the zoning committee, she goes, yeah, I absolutely worry about it.
She worries about it, or
she
predicts it?
She said she worries about it.
She predicted it at the editorial board. I mean, she was basically indicating that there's going to be more than, it's not just going to be Ed Burke, but there are going to be other dominoes to fall, too.
As we're talking about Alderman Ed Burke, he was indicted more, expanded charges from past shaking down the Burger King. Now it's the old post office. Now it's a really strange
case.
Field museum intern. But this is just, I mean, talk about bad weeks. I mean, this is one of the worst weeks in Alderman Ed Burke's history, and I don't know if he survives any of this.
Can I just say, I just did the headlines at 10:30 and wrote something, and I didn't realize how funny it was until I read it on the air. But I said, you know, Mayor Lightfoot today called on Alderman Ed Burke to resign in the wake of his federal accusations.
And we have got to set the standard, which is why I believe it's important for Alderman Burke to resign.
Usually Chicago aldermen wait until they're convicted to resign.
Which, you're absolutely right.
Which is, you know...
Should he resign, Eric?
Yeah, of course he should. I don't think he will. I mean, Blagojevich should have resigned when he was frog marched out of his house. All these guys should resign. They need... There is no impeachment or removal process at the city council level. You can't... You have to wait until he is convicted of a crime to get him out of office formally. So if he wants to stay, he's going to stay.
If you're a defendant, don't you look more guilty if you resign before you're... I mean, I wonder if that's part of it, too, before the trial.
I think that's part of it, but the fact of the matter is, in our justice system, Ed Burke, for all of our kidding and everything, and disdain, frankly, he's innocent right now. Today, he's innocent. So, no, he should not resign. There's no reason to resign. He's an innocent man.
He's presumed innocent.
it's not like it's a mystical religious thing where we make him guilty, but yeah.
It's a legal presumption. I agree with that, but it's, at some point, the cloud over him is so great that he is completely ineffective in his job and probably should take the time to go and devote it to his defense and not to pretend playing ineffective all the time.
I don't think effectiveness has ever been a reason to leave politics.
Yeah, right. I wonder, though, as you look at everything that's playing out, and even some of these charges, this strange thing with the internship and a friend's kid, and I'm gonna shake down the museum for that. They seem very Chicago-style politics. It seems like it's illegal, it's corruption, but it's the Chicago way, and it's been going on for years. Is this the end of the Chicago machine with Ed Burks publicly being just completely eviscerated by the federal government?
Been thinking about that a lot lately, and I don't know. I mean, it's a big behemoth, gluttonous monster that gobbles everything up, and I don't know that its appetites are going to be satiated or if it's going to go away altogether. I can't believe it will.
I would disagree a bit with Scott. I think that the machine, so to speak, has been weakened quite a bit over the years, and it's not nearly what it used to be.
Yeah.
And so, and then we saw that with the ineffectiveness. I mean, Toni Preckwinkle, what is she? How many? She won a few precincts, right? I mean, it was, she just got her complete butt kicked. And she was the head of the Democratic Party in Cook County. So I think that we exaggerate the power of the machine anymore.
Well, we might be conflating or confusing the power of the machine, though, with the power of the Chicago corruption. Right.
Yeah.
So the machine's not there. Is the corrupt machine
still
there?
In the systemic corruption.
Is the systemic corruption? Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question.
And I think that we might be at such a moment in the history of Chicago. I really do think we might be moving toward the end of that.
You're sending a message to all the other aldermen and people around that the way you were doing things that Ed Burke taught you, may perhaps, like, that is not acceptable.
And not just that, but a lot of those aldermen just aren't going to be around for another year or two.
And I think this really underscores the need to make sure that whatever outside jobs these aldermen have, that they are really bland, uninvolved jobs, have nothing to do with city government. So that, you could drive an Uber or something like that, but you can't
be a
cartoonist or columnist. It's like,
right.
Absolutely,
you can't be a Springfield lobbyist and be an alderman.
For them to make sure that doesn't happen anymore, that you don't have these property tax lawyers.
Should they just not have a job at all? I mean, should they? What are the compensated?
That was one of the proposals that came up. I think it's decently compensated. I can see where, and it's problematic if your spouse has a job, if you have investment income. I mean, not everybody has a 9-to-5 job, but clearly the conflict of interest situation is at the root of this. And if you have someone who's got a job like Burke had, who can benefit from the people who are doing business in the city, that's just unacceptable. And when that stops, a lot of this potential for corruption starts to stop as well.
Let's make a transition, go to the national stage. Of course, we saw Robert Mueller, the special counsel for the Department of Justice, and get in front of a microphone this week. Instead of testifying in front of Congress, he kind of tried to shortwire that in a way.
Right.
He went in front of the American people and the press. What'd you make of that? There's a lot I've seen today, thought pieces 2-3 days later, saying he dropped the ball, his punt is becoming more confusing as we move on, that the sort of legalese that was thrown out about you can't convict a president or you can't,
Well, Bob Barr contradicted him there, right? He said that Mueller said that the law says, and he said it was unconstitutional. It's never been before court, I don't think, right? But he said that the guidance is that you can't indict a president, so we had no reason to consider that. Barr then said in an interview that, well, he could have recommended, even though we wouldn't charge him, he could have said he should have been charged.
Yeah, that's we're getting into parsing words.
He came very close to saying that. Here's what interested me about the whole Mueller thing is, when I heard that Mueller was going to speak, I just said, this is going to be disappointing. He has disappointed us in so many ways. Everyone has held him up as this guy who's going to come charging in with a cape fluttering behind him, and that wasn't going to happen. And it was really interesting. He got up there and he didn't say anything new. Nothing that he said was the least bit new. He basically read from his report. And I heard somebody say something like this was like the teacher coming up in front of the class saying, this was what the book said if you had read the book. And the power of that, of him just repeating himself, essentially, inspired people like my congressman, Mike Quigley, and others to go, oh, we've got to impeach now. Like, all of a sudden, like, wait, there was no bombshell. There was no revelation. There was nothing new but the power of him standing in front of people and reading it into a camera, and I think he thought that this was going to make the Democrats not want to call him, because he said he didn't want to testify.
Well, that's the one new thing he said. He said, my report is my testimony.
Is my testimony. But to me, I would say, like, well, bring him in front of the, and have him sit there for 6 hours and read the damn thing, because the public will watch that and absorb it where they haven't read that report.
Yeah, you're right.
I heard someone say something very similar, someone on TV, that the Mueller report was the book. The Democrats now need the movie version to come out.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good way of putting it.
And the committee hearings would be the movie version because we don't read the book.
Scott, do you think that, you know, I have a lot of people filling in this week, texting, saying, you know what, it's over. They didn't prove anything with this report. The Democrats are just grasping at straws to try and get at President Trump when there's just no evidence, and they're they're just parsing. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, there's more to explore here. And that's, I think that... It was so disappointing. I mean, the Democrats have set this guy up initially as some kind of savior. He's going to hand us this report, which will give us the roadmap to impeachment. It doesn't. But the Republicans also vilifying Mueller. I think Mueller did a good job. He had a charge. Here's what you have to look at. He looked at it, didn't expand it into blue dresses or anything else, and came out in 2 years and said, here's what we found. The conclusion on the president is pretty much, well, he's not guilty. You're just kind of going,
it was an impeachment referral. I think what he was essentially saying was,
it's not my job,
Democrats,
your job.
Duh, right. Read this report. It is an impeachment referral. I'm not going to indict him because I can't indict him.
That's not my job, right?
It's not my job.
I do try to project myself a year, you know, a few months from now into 2020 into the election, and let's assume we're in the midst of of impeachment hearings. How does that, I mean, and it's a political process, obviously. Well, how does that impact the 2020 race? I mean, does that make Trump, of all things, a sympathetic character?
Maybe. You know, I think there's the political consideration and there's the ethical consideration. And if this is not a set of offenses, alleged offenses, the obstruction of justice, that requires at least an impeachment inquiry, if not an impeachment trial, at least an impeachment referral, then what is? What would a president have to do to be impeached, given all the things that we know that Trump has done?
Hey, Steve.
I'm just saying, the political calculation, I don't know. It could be really bad for the Democrats, but I think they have to do it.
That was my question, just that there seems to be even more of a push to say that there is a constitutional duty of these officers
and these
elected officials to follow the impeachment referral, regardless of the political consequence.
You can't go on CNN or MSNBC and say that the president is not upholding the Constitution and then not do it yourself. And part of their constitutional duties for the Congress is to prosecute criminals like the president. I don't think it's going to be good for the Democrats, but I also think
it has to be done.
But I think they have a duty to do it. I'm not saying they will. I'm not predicting it. But you could argue that they have. It's their job to do it.
I think that that's absolutely true. And as much as Nancy Pelosi has been somewhat of a, I guess, the person who's holding together the glue of the party, and she has been unwilling to do that, you kind of feel like she's making those determinations for political purposes for the power of the party at a later date. And I don't know if that's any better than what we just saw from what was being investigated from Donald Trump. So I don't know.
I'll say it's better, but it's still not great.
Yeah, so... All right, what else do we want to talk about? As we wrap up here, I want to get to recommendations. Obviously, this podcast is being taped at 11 o'clock. There's going to be so much news in the next 12 hours.
We just don't know what's going to happen. One of the things that struck me about when the week's news was this whole business with the USS John McCain, Trump goes over to Japan and he visits a naval yard. And evidently, he has nothing to do with this, but that there some people from the White House sent word out that we got to cover up the name John McCain and make sure that none of the soldiers or the sailors with their John McCain hats show up at his speech. And
they were well meaning.
They were well intended. That was my
well intended.
That was my But the idea that our president is such a child that he can't even be confronted with this with seeing the name John McCain on a boat without flying into a rage. Now, I think we can assume that that's kind of true.
Not only that he's such a child, but that the people who work for him recognize him as that.
Yeah.
And so even if they did it without him knowing, said, well, we can't let the boss see the name John McCain.
It is one of the strangest stories that I've seen.
It smacked to me as fake news. Like, it smacked to me right because it was from a source, and it was like, White House says he didn't want to see the John McCain name. It, right away, I was like, someone is embarrassing the president when that didn't really happen. And more has come out to say that the aides did do that, but it is, I think the initial story was it was all about Trump, meaning Trump was standing there. I want that, get that battleship out of my sight. which is not how it went down.
Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah, the first thought was that he had said that he had ordered it to be done.
He so said that, torpedoed.
No. The other issue that I think is really interesting is this: is how the abortion issue is playing out around the country and in Illinois. Thursday, right? The bill was signed in Louisiana. You're seeing a lot of these red states, a lot of these conservative states are passing extremely tight restrictions on abortion.
Missouri, Ohio, too.
Well, yeah, but there's a whole bunch of them that have gone. Alabama, Ohio, but Missouri is the last abortion clinic as we speak. I think it's in limbo in courts, but the last abortion clinic in Missouri may be closed. It's closing today, midnight, yeah. I think. And meanwhile, Illinois is zigging while the rest of the country seems to be zagging. The proposal in Illinois is similar to the proposal in New York State, which really liberalizes abortion access here. It gets rid of a lot of the things, you know, like all the kinds of little nitpicky things like the doorway mm-hmm. width and all that. So this is one of the
is this an RNC? Is this a mandate from the RNC to like an issue, a topic that
like
they
the
want
gay
to
marriage
run
thing
on?
Was and
yeah, yeah, because it feels like why is it all happening right yeah. now? Is it to
Brett
tee
Kavanaugh.
Up what's happening?
It's Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, but Brett Kavanaugh's there for life. I mean, they want to get it done before 2020, or they want to run on it for 2020.
I think they want to get it done as quickly as they can. They want to get it to the Supreme Court, and I don't think that the Supreme Court is going to uphold bans like you're seeing in Alabama.
Oh, can't they can't?
But they might. There are some less restrictive bans that are more like, you know, 15 weeks right. or 20 week bans
this week they ruled on one of the abortion cases, the Indiana case, which was a one from Mike Pence in 2016, saying they avoided talking about the actual ban part, but they did do the cremation or funeral services for fetus. That was the big issue that was in the Indiana.
Weird,
they upheld that.
What's weird to me, and what I'm seeing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it just seems that they're stumbling over each other to have the case that goes before
the Supreme Court.
And so it's the, you know, Justin Law or the Steve Law or the Scott Law, and that's the one that makes the cut. And they all seem to be like, we're going to make mine's more draconian. No, we're going to convict the doctors. We're going to, you know, sue the manufacturers of the tools.
Well, I do think, too, this is about changing the law. It's not about running. I don't think they want. I don't think they should want to run on these laws.
They want to get it done.
The majority of the American people are strongly against these laws.
So why? But let's say that you get it to Brett Kavanaugh before 2020. And there is a moment where he upholds one of these bans, picks the one that they like, and they get the one from Louisiana, whatever it is. That they're going to run on that. They have to. I mean, Republicans will be like, we did it. We changed the law. They will be. That will be front and center issue for a 2020 candidate, whether that's for the president or whether that's for whoever's running for House or Senate, whatever it might be. But the point being, it's going to be the issue.
It's already a big issue, and it's going to be an issue because, in all likelihood, these things will not. The rulings won't come down before the election, given the way the pace of these. Because these things have to. They have to go through. They're not going to go right to the Supreme Court. It's going to go to some federal courts, and whatever the ruling is going to be appealed. So it probably will not be decided before the election, but it's going to be a huge issue during the election. And what these laws have done, I think, is they've awakened a sort of sleeping pro-choice majority giant out there. These people who are they're not comfortable with really late term abortions, but they support Roe v. Wade. They support the basic idea that up to about halfway through, it's up to the woman. After that, we want the state to have more say about that. But putting doctors in prison for 99 years and so on. That's not where the public is. Or even victims of rape and incest, that's not where the public is.
But I'm telling you, that's not what their math is on this thing. I just spent a week with my in-laws, and God love them, they're in their 80s, it's a Sicilian. And they watch Fox News 28 hours a day, and they are adamant. They support Trump. They support this agenda, and they will vote. This is a solid 35% of the people. 5 million fewer Democrats voted in 2016 than voted in 2012. That's amazing. So to say that there's a pro-choice, and it's true in the polls. Does that mean they come out and vote? I think the alchemy they're working on right now is exactly what
they haven't. What I'm saying is, I think they have awakened these people. They have galvanized the people who are on the.
But they've got to get out and vote.
I know, but I'm saying I think that this will be the kind of issue that will bring them out to the polls. I think this is a mistake. What the Republicans have been doing for many years, all these ways that they have slowly restricted abortion access, and that has been kind of going on underneath the radar screen, and now suddenly they've come out with these draconian laws, and people are saying, wait a minute, these guys are serious. The rights to abortion are going away. And I think you're really seeing, you're seeing like Netflix is pulling out of Georgia. And I mean, you are seeing some political action and some awakening on the left that you hadn't seen. Scott's right. These people haven't been coming out to vote, but will they come out to vote when this right is threatened?
We had a historic vote here in Chicago, and the turnout was 32%. They had a vote in a mayoral race in Denver recently, 29% turnout. People are voting less. They're not voting more. And so I think that, again, the alchemy in its evil, don't get me wrong, if either side was trying this, but the strategy right now is we're going to energize the space like crazy, and they're going to get out and vote, and the other side doesn't.
Well, our the left voted pretty strongly in the 2018 election. I mean, they came out and they thumped Trump in 2018, and if you can get those people back out to the polls... And then some.
What's different, I think, in 2020 than 2016 is Donald Trump. I believe that the lead up to the 2016 election, a lot of people on the left are like, eh, this is a joke election.
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. I don't care. It's not affecting me. To see how things are progressing over the next 4 years or of the 4 years we're in right now, I think you'll see a lot more Democrats go, oh, this is serious. It's not a joke. That's the kind of concept. All right, let's get to recommendations. We'll wrap this up. Why don't we start with you, Scott? What do you got this week?
Changing subjects and just I'm going back and reading the classics. I haven't and many I hadn't read before. And for instance, the Tale of Two Cities. Dickens is one of my favorites, but I've never been able to plod through that.
Why are you doing that?
Because I think it's important to read these classics and realize why. Yeah, nerd one, but also to recognize why they're classics. I'm just finishing up The Great Gatsby. Never read it before. I have Moby Dick on the nightstand as well. So I would encourage everyone to, if you haven't read them, to read them. There's a reason they're classics.
Mary Schmeek, our colleague Mary Schmeek has like a little book club of people she's convened to read Moby Dick, which I'd say no thank you to Moby Dick, but
I'll call her Ishmael.
Yeah, call her Ishmael. last weekend on our drive to and from Northern Michigan, Johanna and I listened to the audiobook of Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End by psychiatrist and bioethicist Tia Powell. It's part memoir. Her mother and grandmother both suffered from severe mental and related physical impairment at the end of their lives. It's part history, and I recommend skipping the chapters on dementia through the ages. It's part social policy analysis of a growing and extremely costly disease. And it's part guidebook for those of us whose families are experiencing the frustrations and heartbreak of age-related cognitive decline. That's Dementia Reimagined by Tia Powell.
My grandma died of that last year. My mom went through that for 3 years with dementia care. It is
brutal.
Terrible, terrible disease. Mine, on a much lighter note, mine is you have to go to Netflix and you have to check out the Bash Brothers Experience, which is the latest from Lonely Island, which is the Andy Samberg-led comedy group. They imagine a world that Jose Canseco and Mark McGuire did a rap album, a visual concept album like Beyonce's Lemonade. And it is outstandingly absurd, dumb, brilliant all the way through. I was blown away, as my brother said so eloquently, who's got the time for this? And he nailed it. Like, oh, these creative artists who are working in Hollywood somehow found the time to do this really absurd 30-minute Netflix special. And it's one of the best things I've ever seen.
My recommendation this week is, I think it's a repeat of one I did a year ago. The second season of Fleabag is out. And Fleabag was the show on Amazon. It's a comedy sort of a dramedy set in London. It's a sort of catastrophic woman. And when the episode ends, when the series ends, all of a sudden you find that you were watching something that you didn't realize you were watching at all. It was fantastic.
Brilliant.
The second season comes out. It was just out a couple of weeks ago. I finished it. It's not quite as surprising at the end, but it held up. It's still pretty good. So I like Fleabag.
I didn't know. Someone said watch Fleabag, so I went to Amazon to watch it. And I didn't realize there was a first season, so I picked up and just watched the second season, and they kind of sum up the first season right at the top, and I was like, that's enough. It was great. I just watched the second season.
You don't know what happened at the end of the first season,
though. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is she's terrific.
That's the Mincing Rascals for May 31st, 2019. Like we said, there's going to be a lot of news this day as we were taping this morning. Eric Zorn, Scott Stantis, and Steve Bertrand. John Williams back next week. I'm Justin Kaufman. So long.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.